My name is Ken Ewart. I'm a group program manager in the Link team. I've been with Link team now for about 10 years. I did exchange for 12 years before that. The reason I get to stand up here today is I'm actually our compliance manager. So I do a lot of our work in the Link Online space, working with Office 365, and drive an external view of our compliance to auditors, as well as work with the internal operations and development team to build the best practices around security and privacy and stuff. So this is why I get to be here today. Just as a quick show of hands, who here today is actually on Link Online? Okay, considering going to Link Online? Okay, good. This is a 200-level course session, and it's not necessarily going to give you every answer. We could be here for 2 days on this topic. So my goal is to try to just give you a quick survey of the things that we do as Microsoft and Office 365 as we consider your data, your security, and your privacy in the data that you've entrusted us with in the service. So we're going to look a little bit about sort of why this topic is important, why customers actually care. As people consider going into the online space, this is a big thing about, I give up my data. My data is no longer on my premise. Where is it? How do I manage it? Where does it all go? And what are you going to do with it when you get it? So these are all questions that we need to be cognizant of, and we'll walk through. We'll go through, for the most part, the Office 365 trust narrative. A lot of what I'm saying actually spans all of Office 365. It's not necessarily Link Online specific. It applies to SharePoint. It applies to Exchange and so forth. So, you know, you don't get a different answer from every different workload of how they do it and what they do with your data. So we're consistent across all of the offerings. And then we'll do a little quick stop through and look at some of our future investments. You know, this has been a hot topic in the news due to certain individuals. And we'll cover a little bit of that topic right at the end. And so we'll cover the whole gambit. So why is this important? We view that our approach to security and privacy and compliance are an actual differentiator for the service that we're offering you today. Right? It's something that we take absolutely serious, and we make above and beyond commitments to your data. Right, things that we will do to your data and things that we will not do to your data, and the information that you will get about who's been looking at your data and why they've been looking at it. So this is an extreme value add. It's going to add to your the consideration of you moving into the service if you feel comfortable that Microsoft is a good steward of your data and is living by the rules that we've actually laid out. It's going to increase your confidence in the service. Right. You look at the political landscape that's just blown apart here due to the NSA and the PRISM discussion, right? So understanding what Microsoft does and doesn't do in that space with your data, right? We're a regionally globalized deployment. We're in multiple data centers worldwide. So we actually have to participate in a global legal system, right? So we'll talk a little bit about that and how we do that. And then essentially large organizations just need to trust Microsoft with their data. Trust anybody who's taken their data online. And you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was all about privacy statements. You could get away with just having a good privacy statement that said, here's the data that we're going to collect from you, here's what we plan to do with it, and here's what calls home to Microsoft and such. That was the extent of it in those days. Now, as we actually store that data and we become data stewards, we make high bar commitments to what we're going to do with your data and how we will handle it. So understanding all that, especially as you move into the large environments of enterprises versus the consumer market. So when you look at the way to think about this topic, there's kind of three things that you want to deep dive into. The first one is security, right? What do we do to secure your data? And it goes just beyond your data, right? Because we now talk about the data center, the networks, actually accessing the network internally and externally, right? So physical layers, logical layers, all of these things that we have to take into consideration. You then look at, and they're ordered a little bit differently here, but I talk about privacy next. Privacy has got to do with your data in our data center and what we're doing with that data. How do we store it? What are we doing with it? Does it get Googleized? Do we go through the data and look for ad capabilities? Stuff like that. The transparency of the data, how we store it, what your rights are back to your data is also very key. And then you look at compliance. So being the compliance officer, what I wind up saying is, do everything in the service as if we didn't have compliance. Be a good steward, be a good citizen in that sense. Compliance will come around and make sure you're doing it, but don't do it because of compliance. It's the wrong motivation to be a good vendor, to be a good data handler. So we look at compliance as more of the checks and balances of the data security and the privacy layers. Now, we may introduce some high bar activities, like, you know, compliance might say your password actually has to be 48 characters, never repeated in the next 72 passwords. You know, it's just an arbitrary setting, but the compliance team will set that as the high bar, but it's up to the security team to implement that and enforce that at their layers. So if you kind of look at where we started, here's kind of a random timeline of sort of Microsoft in the online space, right? Kind of start off early on with our first data center back in 1989, the acquisition of Hotmail. So the internet going off. Up here is the Bill Gates, the Bill Gates memo of that, you know, about the internet. It took off at, that must be a second one. There was one back here as well. So you see our security response center. A lot of stuff up to this point here was a hybrid between our on-premise world and our online world, right? So our security response center was already up and running for our on-premise products. So if someone deployed Exchange, they found a security flaw, or a researcher found something, we had an entire system and process spun up to deal with that. We fixed the code, we reshipped it. Well, we just extended these same primitives over to the online space. So we have our trustworthy computing initiative. This is where we look at how we develop our code, things about privacy, things that we bake into the products as we develop them and design them. And we'll talk about the secure design lifecycle that we go through at every Microsoft product. And I'll walk you through sort of what an engineering team has to go through just to get their code out into production. Here we are today up in 2013, and Azure coming online adds a lot of new intricacies about where data lives. It's an abstraction layer. It's a fully elastic computing environment. So now you have to say, where is my data running? Where are my processes running? So we take all of that into consideration. So essentially, we've been in this for a long time. Office 365 is not where we've started to play this. Play a role in this. So there's a lot of good heritage and a lot of good pedigree in what we're doing today in Office 365. So let's start with security. So when you look at, when you think about security, there's a couple ways to think about it. There are the parts that we do for security, and then there are the parts that you as the consumer, as the tenant, have to contribute to the security posture. There's only so much Microsoft can do, and the tenant actually has to pick up part of that workload. For instance, when we give you, you go to the tenant admin and you create an account for somebody, you're going to get an account and password back. You securing that is your business. We will give you the password, but you actually have to handle that. That's your secret to manage, right? So you're part of that entire ecosystem in the overall security framework. We also provide you things like DRM. So you can. There are features in the products that allow you to enhance the security of your own interactions, the content you're putting in and out of the service. So you look at the built-in capabilities. This is how we do our job today. This is where we do our running of the operating systems. We run the data centers, how we will stand up and protect the services. So I look at the security stack kind of like the... there's one more. Kind of like a nine-layer stack. And we just basically walk up that stack, and it's all sort of a security defense in depth methodology, right? So the very first thing that you think about in security is it's in a building, right? We have a data center somewhere doing something. So when you think about a data center, you build it, and you put a fence around it, right? You have a physical security barrier to that data center. Once you're inside that data center, you want to protect everything inside that data center. So security, fire protection, fire prevention, those type of activities that just keep the building up and running. AC, water, right? Everything that basically keeps that data center healthy and functioning. Multi-factor auth. Who can get into what parts of the data center and what can they do when they get there and what is recorded about that person and what they're doing, right? So in some racks, you have a video camera taping that rack. There may be something so secure on that data center that you have a video camera 24 hours a day recording whoever touched that rack and what they did. And then that doesn't even talk about the multi-factor access that they have to get into the data center, into that hallway, and then opening up that rack door, right? So now you have essentially all of this multiple authentication methods that are all audited, and then the monitoring on top of that to basically say, we can now reverse the activities and say, something went wrong here. I can tell you, these five people touched this piece of equipment in this time frame, and then work it backwards, and we can actually build the pieces together of what actually transpired. When you think about the building and part of keeping it secure, you know, depending on where the data centers are, we care about seismic activity, we care about water availability, a bunch of things that just keep that the data center going. We have a 24/7 security staff. Now, me personally, I've never been in one of our data centers. I have no business being actually in our data centers, right? So I don't have the rights to go. I can't visit them. There's a tour once in a while that you can that Microsoft will sponsor that I could jump on. But from a day-to-day business, I have no business being in any of our data centers, right? So now you talk about access into that, talk about days of backup power, power generation. As you see, a lot of the online vendors, they're building their data centers closer and closer to power, right? Making sure that that data center has everything it needs 24 hours a day, even during disaster recovery periods, right? And, you know, tens of thousands of servers per data center is common today. One of the things people typically ask me is, okay, so you have all that, but my data, can I get it out? Who gets my data in and out of the data center? There is a very, very strict policy on removable media. Right, so we check everybody going in and coming out. No thumb drives allowed, for instance. There is a provision for cell phones. Cell phones are very ubiquitous. They have storage on them. So there is, for business purposes, the ability to use a cell phone. But other than that, all the servers report and monitor any activity on things like serial ports, USB ports, anywhere that data can be taken off of that server. Those are all actively monitored and measured. So there is no way without triggering an alarm to stick a secondary device into these servers. Now, there are times where it's an okay activity, and that's the exception. So when we have to do those activities, you pre-announce what you're doing, you get it bought off, and so when the alarm is tripped, it's a well-known activity, and it's gone through. It's gone through an exception and approval process, right? And so, and same as people depart the data centers. When they depart, they're completely checked again in order to make sure that they haven't taken any data out with them. Take one next step up, there's a network to consider, right? Now we want to think about the perimeter of the network. The network coming into to the data centers is essentially a public-facing pipe on one side of it, right? We're getting it from an external partner, whether it be MCI, AT&T, some at level three. There's a pipe that's coming in that's not necessarily ours as it enters our data center, right? So we protect that perimeter network. We do things like port scanning. We make sure that only the ports that we know about are made available. We don't every workload that basically publishes something on the perimeter network goes through an approval process to say, we're link, we're gonna open up port 443 for this reason, and it goes through a security review, gets approved, and only then can, in fact, the workload doesn't get to open up that port themselves. The networking team has to go open that port. So there's no way for us to just basically start roguing ourselves and opening up things that we can't get approved by somebody else. we make the request, and they go off and do that for us. And their first answer is no, explain why. There's no easy path through an approval process. Makes things slow, but it makes things more secure. And you have a complete historical record of who asked, why they asked, and what did they say they were going to use it for. And then periodically, let's walk down those ports. Do you still need this port? Have you gotten off that port now? Why is that port still open? How do we close this stuff back down? Are we still using this stuff? So it's not just sort of build it up. We try to tear it down on a periodic basis as well and revalidate everything that we've done. So there's a physical separation between the back end and the public-facing servers, right? There's an interior network and an exterior network. And we basically have firewalls, we have intrusion detection systems. There are a number of things that we do to inspect that data coming into the environment. So we have a pipe coming in. There's lots of data coming in. All right, and so we have to be able to say, okay, is it legitimate data? What's going on, that stream that's coming into our environment, how do we know it's good? So one of the things that you do is you throttle back. So there are well-known behaviors and aberrant behaviors. And not all aberrant behaviors are bad, but you still don't want them impacting your data center. You don't want them to impact your service. So we do traffic shaping. We do an anomalous detection of traffic patterns. And we can basically start to throttle back this IP, communications from that country. Things that we can do to basically mitigate while we're inspecting to make sure it's actually not an offensive attack on the environment. So the other thing is actually, if it's not a malicious attack, there are some legitimate reasons why things go bad, right? In a bring your own device environment, there is bad software on the devices that you have today. You know, if your iPhone or your Windows phone, doesn't really matter what it is, has got a piece of software that's poorly written, and it starts to beat up your Exchange connection. They want to log on, log off every 3 seconds. Well, it's not doing it on purpose, but it's still getting in the way. So we want to be able to throttle that back and say, we're gonna time you out more aggressively and make you come back. And it'll be the point where you need to go fix your stuff before it impacts us. Looks like admin actions, right? Trying to make sure that which admin actions can actually come through and what are they doing. And for the nefarious attacks, a denial of service attack, right? Depending on what, you know, Microsoft is perpetually under attack, as all the large parties are, right? Either it's a DNS attack or it's a flooding attack. We're all under this every day. And so we now have a very robust network. And it's a shared environment, right? We all talk to one another. We know what's going on from, there's blacklisted IPs. And so it's one of those things where everybody contributes and everybody floats the boat a little higher. And everybody's is secure. And so there's a huge sharing network between how we can actually detect some of these denial of service attacks and how to remediate them. So now let's talk a little about the internal network. Internal network is highly partitioned. We have an isolation between the Microsoft corporate network and the Office 365 environment. And we do things here like, how does an administrator, who's a Microsoft employee, how are they administrating that environment? How do they traverse from one network to another? How do they make sure that they're safe and clean as they enter the environment to make sure they're not bringing anything, even by mistake or unaware of, into the environment? We have a separation between the workloads. So Exchange's network is different than the Link network, which is different than the SharePoint network. Part of this comes in the data centers that we're all distributed across, but it's also done on purpose because, as I'll talk about later, we have a model that we assume breach. And that'll sound funny at this point, but when you assume that someone has breached your environment, you need internal partitioning to still prevent that damage that they could potentially be doing. So you not only just say, well, we build a big moat, and if they get past the moat, well, they're in. You still make sure that you have a layered defense on the inside. So we partition the networks and they're segregated and segmented. We talk about, again, on the inside, denial of service and DDoS attacks and traffic shaping, even between environments, to make sure, because there is a relationship between your Outlook client, your Link client, Exchange and Link, because you're swapping data back and forth. So again, if something goes bad on the inside, you don't want to take down another network as well. So we do all of the same goodness outside as we do inside. So now we're up to the host and application layer. This is where, as an operations team, as a workload, this is where we actually get to start playing in the security boundary. These are the things, these are our servers. We own them. The data center is hosting them for us, but the data center is actually ignorant to the application running on them. They don't actually have permissions to the application layer, right? So if you're we call it GFS. That's our data center, the guys who run our data centers. They buy, you know, we buy the boxes from them. They stand them up. They drop them in, and then they're ours. We put an OS on them. We put the applications on top. They are completely locked out of that box from that point forward. They can reboot it. There's a bunch of things that they can do operationally, but they have no administrative access to any of that application layer. So that puts that onus on now the workload. We own those boxes. We need to make sure that they're kept safe and secure. So there's a bunch of things that we try to do in this space. All right? We've talked about auditing. It's our operations team. It's our engineering team that are actually touching those boxes and deploying them, upgrading them, patching them. We want to make sure that we know exactly what's being done on those boxes and by who. So a really robust alerting and monitoring and a system for that. You look at the amount of tooling that's put in place. You don't want to have to touch these boxes by hand. People make mistakes, right? So the more automation, the more tooling we have, provides a consistent activity across 10,000 servers. Last thing you want to do is properly configure 9,999 servers, miss one because it was midnight, because the guy typed the wrong thing in, and now there's your breach head, right? So as much automation, as much consistent tooling as we can put onto those servers as possible. Patching and malware. We have a very aggressive program internally where these boxes are scanned from actually three different perspectives. There is a known vulnerability patching for the software layer, right? So any known vulnerabilities that have been published, they all get scanned for. And we have a sliding scale of, you know, high, medium, low, for lack of a better term. And if it's high, we have 30 days to patch that server. That's across multiple tens of thousands of boxes. If it's a medium, we have another SLA. If it's a low, there's another SLA. So we are, in fact, perpetually scanning these boxes and looking at reports and saying, okay, what are the known vulnerabilities that have come out? And you all get Patch Tuesday mails, right? We get Patch Tuesday mails as well. So Tuesday morning, Patch Tuesday shows up. We wind up with a list of reported vulnerabilities. That goes into the scanning engines. And now we know exactly what our exposure would be to that newly released vulnerability and what our plan is going to be to mitigate that across the environment. We also look at configuration. So there is a base standard of configuration on these boxes. So for instance, if you don't need Adobe Reader on your box, it shouldn't be there. Internet file and print shouldn't be turned on, right? So you have this scanning that's perpetually looking at this solid baseline of what a secure server looks like. And if anybody takes that server out of spec, I just need to put Adobe Writer on here for a second to look at this manual on the disk drive that we just put in here. So I'm going to install Adobe Reader, read the manual, and then I'm going to walk away. We're going to catch that, and we're going to make sure that gets turned off, and we're going to patch that and restore it back to its secure state. The other thing we do is, this is where the development team and the engineering team comes into play. They follow the security development lifecycle. Now, this is all the effort it takes a developer to write the code and get it through the quality assurance, through into production. And I have a whole slide on this, but this is where all of this starts to take shape. So if you look at our admin, they're a rare breed. There's not as many admins to the system as you might actually think it takes, right? Because at scale, what you don't want to have to do is scale out physical bodies. That's where that tooling comes back into play. Whether it's one person doing something on 10,000 servers or a million servers, it should still take the same amount of people. So when you keep that number of people who are administrators low, that's your first level of defense. All right? We do things like, who is this administrator? We go through background screens. We have multiple environments today, some of them more government flavored, some of them more dedicated flavors, and each of them have a different level of background screening that they require. So for instance, we're just bringing online into the online environment the Criminal Justice Institute process. And this is in for the states. Every state, so you take a police department, a sheriff, whoever it is, if they want to use Office 365, we actually have to have the admins who touch those boxes go through a per-state background screening process. Doesn't mean that they're actually going to store criminal data in there, but they may have communication. There may be a portion of criminal data that's being put through that system, so we actually have to hold up the bar to our administrators that they've passed all those background screenings. As we get more into the federal space, that goes even higher. It can even get as high as you must be a U.S. citizen. You must be on American soil. There are varying level of degrees depending on our environments. We make sure that our admins meet that letter of that requirement before they're given access. Their access is gated on having met all of those criteria. If you lose one of those criteria, so I pass my background check and a year later or whatever the period is and they come back and they recheck me, if I lose my status, I left the country, I no longer pass my background check, automatically my permissions are removed at that moment and I no longer have access to the systems. Doesn't require a person to go, well, Joe's still okay, we'll leave him in there for a little bit. It's all automatic. You're bumped up and you're bumped down based on these automatic processes that we have. You're highly trained. You go through on-the-job training, you go through desktop training. You just don't get a key to the environment and say, go on and go learn and explore. You wind up having to be fully trained before going into the environment. So we take this set of people very, very seriously, and we hold them to a very, very high bar. One of the ways that we do that is it's called a zero access privilege model. So if you think about what an admin can do, by default, they should be able to do nothing, right? They have no need to be able to do anything. Now, when the need arises, they need to ask for permission, ask for the right to do something, be granted that right, perform that activity, and then give up their authentication model, right? So we have a combination of an RBAC, which is a role-based admin model. So people doing backups should only have this set of functionality available to them. People doing user management or server management, you look at the roles that we've defined, and that limits the scope of what they can actually even ask permission to do. But standing permissions should be zero at that point. They ask for them, they're given them, they use them, and then they're returned or they're thrown away. So when you look at this, up here, you take an admin, they're coming in from the corporate network, right? And we have secure jump boxes that allow them to traverse. The boxes that they're using are not actually their physical boxes. They're moving onto a virtual environment to which they can then get into the production environment. So they request, and they go through what's called a lockbox, right? This is a process by which it says, who are you? What permissions are you asking for? What permissions should you be able to ask for? You do the union of all of that, and what comes out of that lockbox is a temporary key that says, here's a password or here's an authentication token that you get to use for 2 hours, for 3 hours, for whatever you've asked for. In that time period, that will be at the expiry of that time period, that authentication is no longer valid, and you go back to a zero access model stance. So in there, we talked about in order to get that, we validate all the stuff again. Have you done all your good admin stuff as part of that process? Grant temporary privilege, and off you go. So now let's talk about the admin as a user, right? Actually, where did this one? You know what? They actually duplicated this slide. Let me go to another one. There we go. So once we got past the admin, now let's look at sort of the customer data. This is still floating around that network. This is still floating in the environment, right? You're a multi-tenant environment, which means you're sharing resources with other tenants, right? You don't get your own Exchange server. You don't get your own Link server. So you're in a shared total resource, total capacity environment. But we do segregate the data. We have a partitioning model that says if you are a link customer and you're customer A, your customer content, the meeting uploads that you put in there, the meeting notes that you have there, your contact list, all those things are partitioned from other customers. They may be in the same data store, but it's not a matter of we try to do a massive filter and just say, well, we think these are just yours. There is no ability for you to stumble onto another tenant's data, right? We've partitioned it, we've locked it down. You're only ever going to get your data back into the system with no access to other pieces of the system. So if you think about it, it's the last thing you want to do is start up a link session and have somebody else's PowerPoint sitting in your space that shows, you know, that maybe they're a pharmaceutical company, maybe they're a bank, and they're showing mergers. And you would not want your data exposed that way, nor would you want to find it. So clear partitioning that keeps that data absolutely separate. So some of the things that we do to layer on top of this even further, we use BitLocker. Now, BitLocker does not qualify for encryption at rest. What it is, it's encryption at rest at the media level, right? It doesn't mean that when the drive is up and running, the data is sitting there encrypted at the application layer, right? BitLocker is there to say that hard drive, when it is removed and it's taken out of the context of the operating system, it's taken out of the workload, that data is secured, right? You can't open that up on another computer and just start rifling through the data. This is a asset level protection mechanism, right? Lots of drives going in and out of boxes, they wear out, they have to be replaced, drives start going faulty. What happens when a drive goes faulty? One of the GFS engineers looks at what kind of drive it is, pulls one off the rack, pulls that one out, puts a new one in, they start to synchronize, it goes back, but there's now a drive in that fellow's hand or gal's hand that they need to now destroy, right? And so what you don't want is your data in the clear going off to a pile of drives that get recycled once a week or whatever it is. So we use BitLocker just to protect the asset media layer to make sure that as your data is taken out of the production environment, it is not exposed in any way, shape, or form. It's 128 or 256-bit encryption at that point. We're forever notching up our encryption levels as software begins to become out of support. So for instance, what we had to do because of Windows XP, when Windows XP is finally out of the environment, we're going to up the level of our minimum requirements to no longer have to account for Windows XP, and we'll just keep moving that bar higher and higher. I'll talk about this a little bit later when we talk about our future investments, but we're forever evaluating the environment saying, do we still need to do this? Can we up this bar? Encryption in transit. This is, speaking specifically from the link side, we encrypt everything in transit. We encrypt from your client into the first hop into the server, into the environment. We encrypt from every server to server hop. And we will encrypt for every connection that we make to a partner like Exchange or to SharePoint, right? We encrypt everything in transit. And so it doesn't matter if it's traveling on a public network or it's traveling on the interior network, right? It's part of that assume breach mentality. It costs more to encrypt inside the data center, right? You would think there's no reason to do it. We're just adding extra overhead to the process. Assume breach. Assume somebody is in the data center doing something that they shouldn't be. Don't make it easy for them, right? Keep everything encrypted everywhere along the way, and you keep a better defensive posture. So, just in summary again, this is sort of our security in depth model. You'll have the slides. I think there are some links in there that you can click on and dig deeper on some of these topics. This is one that, being on the engineering side, and in a previous life, I was a release manager. This is a framework that every product at Microsoft has to go through. This is, it's done by our trustworthy computing team at Microsoft, and it's meant to have a level playing field or a standard bar for Microsoft to develop and release software. And it's a phased approach, and it's iterative. And it's basically, it says, how do you, right from the beginning, build in security, privacy, and all of these things as you're developing software? The last thing you want to do is develop your software and then show up and say, well, I'm not sure if it's secure or not. Let's tear it apart and see if it is. So we go through this process, iteratively, either at the milestone level or at even on a weekly level. So we start kind of right over here, and we look at, just training. Every year, every engineer is required to undergo certain amounts of training, be it privacy, be it security, be it a bunch of things. It's just their general knowledge has to be, the way I like to describe it, they're not all going to be professionals in security and privacy, but they're going to be sensitive enough to know what they don't know and then bring in people who are actually more dedicated experts. So we train them all to a point where they know enough to basically say, I need help here. Let's bring the help in. So lots of training involved. Then you walk through a requirements scenario. What are we building? Who are we building it for? What are the scenarios that we're trying to solve? And up front, you define your quality gates, right? Anyone who defines their quality gates at the end is lying, because you define your quality gates based on what you're looking and saying, well, we think it should do this, we think it should do that. So you define your quality gates and your release criteria up front, and then you're measured against that perpetually throughout the system. You then do things like security and privacy risk assessment. You haven't written a line of code yet, but you start to think, where is this thing going to be attacked? Where is it going to be deployed? What are the things I need to be worried about? Is this going to be on a hostile environment, like a hotel network? Or is this going to be in the data center? So I start doing some risk mitigations, and it helps me frame exactly how I'm developing this code. We then go through a set of design. We do an analyzed surface attack and threat modeling. So this, we're writing code at this point. We actually have something to touch and feel. We know how it's going to work. And then we start to say, okay, let's get everybody into a room. Sometimes these are people that are not even on the team, and say, what can you do with this? Right? I'm in this environment. I have these ports open. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. This is my design. Attack it. So now let's threat model it. What happens if you flood this port? What happens actually if you actually go after this ACL, or you actually have the permissions to do X, Y, and Z? What happens if that gets overloaded, or what if someone doesn't authenticate? So you attack it on paper, and you have the engineers go, I never thought of that, or we'll go back and fix this, or we got that one covered. Here's what we do. So we build up a complete threat model of this feature, this functionality, as we're going through design. Right? Implement it. When you start writing code, every day you're checking in code to what we call our source code repository. That source code repository is in what we periodically take it, build the product, spit it out the build machine, and then we start giving it to testers or other people to play with. Well, that source code goes under a huge amount of analysis, static analysis, just by virtue of being checked in. So it's not even built yet. And we're doing analysis like, do you have dangling pointers? Do you actually have uninitialized variables? And that's the easy ones that people know about. There are hundreds and hundreds of things that we can actually look for in source code. And it's all done by the time you check in. You check in, these tools are ran against it, and if we find anything, you have bugs opened up against you automatically by the system. And so you have to start working on those bugs to mitigate what you just checked in right away, or you don't get to move to the next step. Right? So you instantly get that feedback of what you've done in order to start remediating it, and not look at it and say, well, I built this great thing, now I got 5 months of work to fix it and clean it and make it secure. You do it iteratively over time. Then we get into verification. You start doing things like if you have a file format. So Link luckily doesn't have file formats, but you look at the Office team, you look at Word, you look at Excel, you look at PowerPoint, you look at Exchange. They have a file canister that they move around. There's a format to that file. People read those files. They parse them. They deserialize portions of those files. Well, that's ripe for injection. How many of you know that, that any of these file formats, that's where the payload of viruses travel around. They can jam stuff in there. So you own the security of your file format. Who can hide what where, and how do you detect it? Right? The application opening that file is responsible for validating the content of that file. right? So you're obligated to make sure that you only pull out the pieces you know and you recognize, and you leave everything else behind, right? So we do file fuzzing, more attack surface reviews. As you know, by this point here, you're done. As a developer, as an engineer, you've checked everything in. It has passed all the quality bars. It's ready to go. But now, it's not over. What happens after you deploy that code, whether it be on-premise or actually in the service? How do you get involved when a breach is found or when a flaw is found? What's your security response plan? When the phone goes off at midnight, who gets called? In what order? Who gets brought into the discussion? You have to have a security response plan and a final security review sign off. So you're still not done yet. Finally, every piece of software is archived. We can rebuild it. We can go back to the source code of any given date and time. We can tell exactly who did what when. If you want to check in some code, we'll know who checked it in. We know when they checked it in, how long it's been in there. So things happen. Vulnerabilities are discovered daily. What you can do, though, is once you analyze the vulnerability, you can actually tell when that vulnerability was introduced in the source code. You might actually have to mitigate two releases in the wild because it was introduced two releases ago. But at least now we can tell exactly when it was introduced, who introduced it, and now we know the scope of our remediation requirements in order to fix that vulnerability. So it's not a matter of writing code as fast as you can. There's a lot of archiving. There's a lot of paperwork in order to validate what we can, because we're going to look backwards. We know we're going to look at this again 3 years from now, so we have to leave it in good shape. And then finally, you're out in the wild, and then the way you execute your incident response plan. I'm going to talk more about this one, but these aren't things that you've just defined on paper and you hope they never come to fruition. We will test your security response plan. We will do artificial war games. We will trigger false alarms and make sure that the plan that you've put in place executes and fires. These are muscles, right? Like anything else, if it's a muscle if you go to the gym and think, I really like to work this out, but I haven't quite done it yet. I'm working on my legs or I'm working on something else. This muscle doesn't get flexed. When it comes time to do it, it's not going to be there for you. So we are perpetually making sure that there's no atrophy in our processes, making sure that there's nothing winds up getting old and stale. So we wind up doing these response ticket plans, and I'll talk a little bit more about those in a minute. So I talked a little bit about this. Up until a couple years ago, the model of security was, prevent breach. Do whatever you can to prevent breach. Dig your moats deeper, build your walls higher, do everything, fingerprint, eye scan, retina. You think of all of that stuff that prevents breach. Well, like every good sci-fi movie, somebody can get in. I've seen the attacks where you can foil a thumbprint reader with a gummy bear, right? So there are ways to bypass your prevent breach methodology. So we've taken, a step beyond that, and we will assume breach. And what that means essentially is, if you look at this first part, that's kind of that part in orange is everything that we kind of just talked about, that secure lifecycle model, everything that we talked about that makes sure that when it leaves, it's the best that it can be. Assume breach says we know something will go wrong. We know that somebody is going to get in one day. What do we do? How do we determine that they're in? How do we know what they've touched? How do we now have to be able to say, we need a forensical view of what just happened and how it happened and what the scope of something is. So we assume breach at that point. And what does that mean? So here's some of the things that we do in assuming breach, right? We are looking for abnormal behaviors, things that just don't look right. We don't have an explanation for, but we don't know. So we have tons of logging that is just collected. If you can imagine, tens of thousands of servers, Windows security event logs, application event logs, there is a ton of data being generated just at run state. We take that data And it gets analyzed every day, every hour, looking for things that just look anomalous. And when we find something anomalous, you trigger an alert and say, don't know what it is, might be okay, but someone should go look at this. Go validate that it's okay. Do we have an explanation for what just happened? Because if we don't, let's assume breach. Until we know what's going on, let's assume that there's something nefarious going on and that we need to get to the bottom of it. Not put it on the list for later. We want to start digging into that now, right? We want to look at things like how do you recover? How do you respond to these? Who needs to know? Who doesn't need to know? When you do a breach, you would think the first thing you do is start shutting things down and making a whole lot of noise and trying to protect yourself. Well, you know what? You try not to tell the person who you believe to be in the system that you know they're in the system. So there's a risk balance there to say, okay, without spooking them, we need to box them in, or there's a lot of things we need to do to mitigate what's going on and just not make a whole lot of noise. Who do you tell? How do you tell? Who gets notified? Legally, who gets notified? All of that gets put into play, right? Scope of on-site testing and security response plan to improve mean time to detection and recovery. That's that muscle that we talked about. We do war games. We do penetration testing. We do things where alarms just happen, and we test the response that happens, and we measure how long did it take to do this activity. Were the right people spun up in the conference? Did they understand what was going on? Did they have the right access to do what they needed to do? Last thing you need to do is fire up 50 people into an environment and say, none of us can do anything because we let our access lapse, or we don't have the right permissions, or our background screenings are all gone. Doesn't work that way. You always have to be prepared, and we're always running those systems through testing. We do internal attack. We talked about this. We trust our admins, but we don't, right? They are as much a possibility to our security threat as anything else. They're people, they're humans. They actually have emotions. They get angry, right? And so one of the biggest threats, actually, when you look at these environments, you think about the guy outside sitting in his mother's basement hacking your system. Realistically, it's your internal employees that actually expose part of the biggest risk. These are your friends. These are the people that you know and you work with and you're alongside of them. So it's hard to look at them across the table and say, one day I won't trust you. But that's exactly how we deal with it, right? We look at it and say, okay, we try to protect their activities and don't give them the opportunities to go rogue on us. Right? Every time we find either it's a breach or an assumed breach, or we run any of the activities, we post-mortem it. What happened? Did it work as it planned? What didn't work well? How should we fix this? What processes do we actually need to re-educate on or reinvent? We're always changing and post-morteming what happened, and so can we learn from any of that? So this is kind of a model of you can think about when you assume breach. Assuming breach, we do what's called war games. There are people in Microsoft who are blue hat hackers. These are people in the company who have the gift of breaking into things, right? They're the attacking team. They're treated. This is a formal exercise that we go through. They get source code access. They're the best educated attacking team that we can put together, right? They get a little bit of a leg up, but not too far, because they're no different. They're employees that can do have access to a lot of the same tools, but they're educated. They then come in and they will set up a war game where they will start to try and break into the systems. They will make use of inside Microsoft knowledge. They know where the product studio database is for the bugs, and they know where this is, and they know where that is. And they actually begin to put up a really good attack, right? Because you can't keep everybody out. Our employees have to get into the system, so there are ways to get into the system. How can those be exploited? How can they work through them? So they come in as the red team. So they're coming in and they're attacking. They will set up a simulation. We will not know what's going on. There'll be a few of us that know because When we are in this scenario, I actually get to know when the pen test is happening, because parts of my team, they will want to hit the nuclear button when they actually find somebody in there. And we don't want to make sure when we're pen testing, we don't make a public disclosure about this, right? So we have referees like me who get to play and say, okay, stop. We're in a pen test. Now that you know we're in a pen test, go back to what you're doing. Start defending. But we're going to stop right here. We're not actually going to start formatting disks. We're not going to start doing some of the things that would actually be destructive that we would do in a real breach, but there's a limit to what we would actually do during the exercise. So you have referees like me going in and standing between the two teams and making sure that things don't get out of hand. But for all intents and purposes, the operations team has no idea this is going on. Because if they knew, they'd start looking. And that's not what you want. Because if they should be looking anyways. This is part of their day. There should be no other hint that this is going on in their life until they actually start getting the real alarms. Right? You have a blue team. A blue team is the team that shows up when we detect something. Right? We have multiple workloads and multiple engineering teams. There are people in the company who are specifically trained. Think about the emergency response team, like the SWAT team, when you have a police type action. You have a bunch of police officers, and they all have weapons, they know what to do with them, but you have a specialized team come in, incident response, command and control center, they start dictating, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna do this, and we're gonna do that, and I need you to do this, go get me those logs. And we have a command and control model. And the blue team comes in. If it were real, these are the same folks that would be called in if we thought we'd been breached. They would come in and they would take over the incident. We would become actors and we would become participants. They run the incident for us. So that is a muscle that needs to be flexed. They just can't wait for a real event to happen. They don't know what the red team is doing, so they're just as surprised. They have no idea what the red team has done. They're in the dark too. Let's all start looking. What do the log files say? What are this? Okay, here's a thread. Pull that thread. That didn't pull anything. Okay, here we go. So they start doing an actual blind breach hunt as well. We go through this process. The attacking team either gets in or doesn't get in. They may have made noise along the way, determine if we could detect that they were making noise. All of these things go into then a post-analysis. More often than not, they will have a report that says, here's what we did on what days and what times. The blue team will come back and say, here's what we saw on what days and what times. And here's what we did. We found you in the environment, and we did X, Y, and Z. And they'll come back and say, that kicked us out. We were in the environment, and that kicked us out. Or, well, you found four of them, but you left this fifth one over here, and that let us go right back in a day later. Right? So then we do this big execute of a post-breach activity and say, okay, what did you do? What did you find? And that just goes into the next learnings. And every workload goes through this. So we'll go watch the Exchange pen test. They'll come watch ours. And everybody, their education level just floats higher and higher every time we do one of these. Right? And then we go back to monitoring for real threats. Right? So this virtuous cycle here just keeps flexing that muscle over and over and over again. So we're always prepared for when it becomes a real activity. So there's that penetration. I covered most of this here in the talk. The thing to know about is that what I talked about was more of the internal pen testing. There are external companies that will actually try to attack Office 365 from the outside, right? Certain industry verticals have a requirement that for any of their providers that there's an outside company that tries to do a penetration test. They essentially become a tenant. They get an account, and they get just an admin and however many accounts that they want, and they're no different than you folks. They just get that as a foothold to start beating up on the system. And this one has never actually been breached, as far as I know, right? We've not been breached from the outside yet. So we do that. There's a list of people that we deal with. There's a top 10 list for people who do this work, and depending on the customer type in the vertical, and for government, we actually do have a requirement to report out the progress and the activities. So we don't get to do this completely in the dark. If we're failing miserably at this, it doesn't just stay inside Microsoft. We actually are obligated to report this stuff out. And okay, so This is not done in a black box. We're held accountable to this, and it's not, I wouldn't say public, but it's not hidden. Yeah?
So you say yes, do you anticipate that you will be breached from the outside? I mean, you're saying that.
Do I anticipate we'll be breached? Yes, which is why we assume breach. Do I want to be breached? No, Target didn't want to be breached either, right? Someone, you have to just assume you are going to be breached. Anything other than that is being naive, right? You can compartmentalize stuff. Well, if we're never going to be breached, I don't need to do that. So it's not, yes, you're about to lose your data any day now at Microsoft. That's not what I'm saying. But we assume the likelihood is that when somebody gets in, we have the right things in place to mitigate what they've done. So you look at some of the outsider attacks that we work on. You know, we do pen testing, port scanning, vuln scanning, OS patching, message hygiene, whether that's an email message or a SIP message coming in. There's a hygiene monitoring, are these well-formed packets, session border controller type stuff, deep packet inspection. There's a lot of stuff that goes on just to make sure the outside coming into the environment is well understood. Excuse me. This one here, zero human set engineer passwords. Admins don't know their passwords. They're complex. They check them out, they check them back in, they're generated new ones. So there's no one that can say, Candy Apple 12 is my password for the admin port, right? So we take away some of that human engineering factor out of it. And so you really can't run the passwords through a dictionary checker. You can't run, there's just no way to bust in just because we have a lax admin who just felt that this password change didn't want to be as robust as previous one. So things like this, anything that comes in from the outside, we check on. This is the one that's most interesting. This is the insider attack, right? This is the rogue admin. This is the person with Microsoft knowledge inside the system that we try to plan for, right? 2FA required for all service access. So just because someone has an account and a password doesn't get them into prod. We all have, and I'll show you mine. We all have a card key with a chip in it, right? Two-factor auth. I not only need to know the other admin's password, I need to have his card in my possession in order to get into the environment, right? Even going up higher, there's additional factors of auth that we're looking at adding to this, right? Just really making it sure that the person who came in is the person that claimed to have come in. You don't want someone to say, that's my account, but I wasn't there on Tuesday. It wasn't me, right? That's a failure in the system. No one should ever be able to say, it wasn't me. So zero standing permissions in the service. We talked about that already. You don't have anything at your fingertips until you've asked for it. Go back, and we look at lists over and over again on a monthly basis. Who's an admin? Right, let's just look at the list. Who's an admin today? Why is this person on the list? Did they get background checked? There's a new person on this list. Or that person, and it should not happen because we have processes in place. But if you look at the list and say, Joe left last week. Why is he still listed here? Kick him out, right? So we rely on automation and business logic to do that for us. We validate manually by looking at these lists and validating we know who's got what where. All right? Patches encryption tools. We talked a lot about this already. Talked about the security incident response. This is an automatic process in Microsoft. When the ticket gets opened, if it gets opened in the right way, meaning there's a field that says, is this a security incident? Yes, no. You fill out that ticket the right way, and it kicks off an entire workflow automatically. You say, yes, this is a security issue. The blue team gets automatically paged and woken up. They wind up coming in, a conference is spun up. This process just takes on an automated life of its own. So depending on what you do, right, we have an alert, we look at it, we try to classify the incident, we determine that it may be a breach, we trigger off the type of breach it might be, or if it's an internal, some of that might actually trigger a customer notification and that's an obligation that we have. If your data is breached, you'll get a notification. So all of this is not left up to anybody's discretion. If it meets this criteria, this will happen. There's not one manager that goes, I'm going to get fired. If so-and-so knows that this happened, I'm going to get fired. He's no control over that. He or she's got no control over that. These processes are all workflow driven. They're automatic. So as there's human intervention in them, but as they progress and we know more and more about them, the things automatically happen, right? All the way back up to a post-mortem review. Customer may or may not be involved at that point, but all of this is under automatic control. Hello. All right. User access. This is something that you as the tenant have some responsibility in. All right. We integrate with Active Directory. You replicate your AD into our AD, so we know a lot about your users, and you're the ones who are providing their access. If you want to give Joe an account in Office 365, you've gone and done that. You've provisioned them in the service, right? So we do a bunch of things around federation authentication. We do password synchronization, two-factor auth, role-based access control. All of this, though, is what you as a tenant contribute to protecting your own environment. There are secrets that we hold. There are secrets that you hold. You are responsible for protecting your parts of the secrets. So here's a list of some of the security risks that we actively look at and try and mitigate against, right? We talk about, you know, malicious access to data as it walks physically out of the data center, access to data during the service being run. So if you walk down this list, you can see what we're doing here in order to mitigate those risks in our processes. I got three slides like this. I recommend we can walk through them later individually if you want, but this is something more just to go off and read yourself and get a sense for all the things. Everything that we talked about here in this list is what we've already talked about in the previous slides, but it ties it back to specific threats and risks that we are mitigating against. We talk about encryption keys getting compromised. We have to be able to roll certificates and passwords at short notice. So, for instance, if there were a breach, or when we go through these war games, and someone, their credentials are stolen, we have to be able to flip everybody's credentials. I'm amazed. So I get to sit and watch these pen tests go on, and I get to sit and watch the blue team when they start doing their breach hunts. And I get to see what the hackers actually did. It is absolutely amazing. This isn't some guy hacking at a password and just gets onto this server and then gets onto that server. The things that the hacking community does, the tools that they're just at their fingertips to crack passwords, to steal this and gain a foothold, it's amazing. And to watch these guys, and some of the things you do is, at the right moment, you flip everybody's password. So now you've put up a block. They no longer have access to the passwords that they had 5 seconds ago. But if that takes you an hour, well, they're already ahead of you. While you're changing passwords, they're already grabbed the next one because that one was still available while you started changing this one. So you have to be actively fast. You have to be decisive. And that's why I say you don't make a whole lot of noise at first. You stage what you're going to do to defend these people, and then you start to execute, and you put them in a box as much as possible at the end of all that so they can't really do anything more. Malware coming into the environment, whether that be through content that you provide into the environment, your Word docs, your PowerPoints, or however it got into the environment, right? We have to make sure that we can handle all of that. Malfunctioning software. You know, it doesn't actually have to be malicious, but you can actually have bad consequences just by having bad software, right? So we have to be able to protect and recover from that activity. Right? Interception of content, interception of communications, all of this here we cover as well. All right, privacy. This is the topic about what we say we're going to do with your data or not do with your data. And it comes down to sort of some key pillars, right? No advertising. We're not going to look at your content. We don't want your content. You've graciously given it to us to be a data steward. We're holding on to it for you. We do not have any rights to your data. So the only thing that is more of an exception to that is when you do hygiene filtering, right? When you do spam and you do that type of thing, that content, while it's machine looked at, there is no human looking at that content, nor is the content used in any residual way after that activity is concerned. So it's your data. Transparency. Yeah. You know what? I have slides at the end of that. So at the end of the deck, I have slides just on that topic. The question was, is it U.S. data or is it the government data? Or is it our data or the government data? We'll cover that in a second. Transparency. Clearly, clear policies, clear statements, what we're going to do with your data, and then the privacy controls we put in place to do that. So the first thing here is about advertising. Will we use your advertising to build products? From the Office 365, no. We will not advertise. We will not look at your documents, your emails, and say, hey, you talked about a new boat, so let's give you ads for boats or anything like that. So just completely off limits, right? Who owns the data I put in your service? You own your data. You own the rights. You retain the rights to your data, right? You can take your data anytime you like. There are provisions in the Office 365 Trust Center that says it's your data. If you want to pick it up tomorrow and leave, we have to give it to you. We have to make that an easy process. We have to help you migrate off. So it's transparent. Your data, you're in control of it. We don't have the rights to do anything with it. Transparency, we talk about where the data is stored, who accesses the data, and why it's accessed, and when you get notified, right? All laid out very prescriptively on what the rules and obligations are when your data is being touched, right? When you look at where your data is stored based on the information you gave us when you provisioned your service. So if your billing address is in the United States, you're a U.S. tenant for all intents and purposes. If your billing address is in Belgium, you're a European tenant, and you'll be provisioned in Europe. So you, based on your billing address, you have full knowledge of where your data is going to be stored. If you look at the EU model clauses, which is not as much of a certification, but it's a agreement that the European Commission has come up with that said, if you can follow all of these rules, you get their stamp of approval, and it's the EU model clauses. EU model clauses are very clear about who can touch the data, whose data it is, how long it's retained for, how long, if it's got customer information in it, like a username, joe@europeancompany.com, how long can we keep that information in our log files, in our systems? So we're actively forced to purge data that we have no business need for anymore out of our systems. And all of that comes from this transparency of we follow these rules, and that's what you can expect from us. How privacy is protected, you can talk about, as part of my compliance role, we look at things like what rights do we have to the data and how do we have to handle them? We break down the data into various classifications, right? Content being one of them, user information, tenant information, secrets. So we have a classification of data, and depending on what the data is, we have a different handling process and a different lifespan to that data. So it's not just we get all rid of data in 9 months or 3 years. We have a very complex matrix, depending on the data, whose it is, how long we have to keep it for, right? So things like address book data, things like voluntary, do we have to do voluntary disclosure to law enforcement? All our handling of your data, we account for in the trust center and in the documents that you get as being a customer. All right, compliance. I said earlier that compliance really is the check and balance to everything that we just kind of talked about. We are certified in a bunch of industry standard certifications, things like ISO, SOC, FISMA, EU model clauses, HIPAA. These are the certifications that we actively go out and get, and that list is perpetually growing. But if you look at sort of the crux of all of those certifications, they're validating, do you behave in a way that meets this minimum bar? What's your security like? What's your passwords like? Well, you know, it's a very in-depth. Our control set is somewhere in 900 controls that we walk through. And it goes all the way, do you have a document that says this? How often do you review that document? Who actually? So it's a very detailed checklist that we have to go through. And we look at it as this is everything that we should be doing anyways. And the compliance program just ensures that we collect the evidence and that we hold ourselves accountable for what we're doing. Right? So what does it mean to, what does compliance mean to customers? It means something different to everybody. If you look at a financial services company, their compliance requirements are different than Walmart's, than Boeing's. So compliance means something different to everybody. We're going to talk about what standards we meet, the difference between organizational compliance and regulatory compliance. So again, built-in capabilities on our side, what we do for compliance, and the things that you have to do to control your own compliance posture. Again, it's not something that Microsoft does all by itself. You play a role in being meeting your own compliance controls. Right, so we have global compliance standards. I list them off here, ISO, EU model clauses, HIPAA, FISMA, and we're contractually obligated to meet these standards and retain these certifications. Right, so we're making the commitment that we will forever have these standards. Right, so what is this meant to address? We actually look at it as independent verification on a regular basis, and I probably do 4 to 5 audits a year for various certifications, but they all wind up looking very similar. So about 4 or 5 times a year, an independent auditor sits across the table and says, show me this, show me how that works, show me this doc. Oh, you have a ticketing system, I wanna see that ticket, and you gave me a list of 50 to pick from, show me that one, show me the life cycle, show me everything that happened there. And they just make sure that we validate it. They hold us accountable to what we've been doing here. Regulatory compliant is, again, individually customer-based. If you're a financial services customer, you have a bunch of obligations that you are internally required to meet yourself. SEC, DOD, these are requirements that are placed not on Microsoft, but on you as an organization. Let's say you're a medical practitioner. You're under HIPAA, right? You're the one responsible for your HIPAA accreditation. Microsoft actually ensures that if you use our product, there's nothing that we will do that will actually get you in trouble with HIPAA, but you can get yourself still in trouble with HIPAA. If my dentist wants to put my dental x-rays in a piece of email and start emailing it around the office, they have broken their HIPAA obligation. Not the fact that it was in an exchange system floating around. We made sure that if they did the right thing happened on the inside. So there's an obligation as you, as the tenants, you hold your own compliance obligations that you participate in behaving in compliant ways. So if you look at sort of the standard certification, some of them are very regionalized. HIPAA is very US-based. FedRAMP is a US-based. EU model clauses is clearly in Europe. The MLPS, that's more in Asia, China. So these are all the different certifications that we wind up going through. And as you can imagine, there's a fellow that wants to come in and ask us questions about each and every one of those on a regular basis, right? We have markets that we have to worry about, verticals, local government, federal government, police, financial. They bring their own certifications into the environment, right? And as well as it's regional based, right? So it's a pretty deep matrix. And it continues to grow every year with the recent revelations about Snowden and the NSA. A lot more regions are coming up with their own protections that they're now putting in place. So it's becoming more of a globalized nature to put their own protections in place. So if you look at sort of what we do today, we talked about all these built-in capabilities. These are the things that you guys can do yourself in the running of the service. So if you're running Exchange, you have S-MIME capabilities. So you can add your own layers of protection. DLP, data loss prevention. Things that you can do to make sure that your IP is not leaving your environment. So whether that be routing rules or filtering. For instance, in DLP, data loss prevention, and you look at link, if you actually screen share your desktop, we will not screen share a DRM'd document. So I don't know if you've ever been in an environment where someone says, hey, let me show you this PowerPoint, and on the other side, it's black to you. You can see the rest of their desktop, but that PowerPoint is black because it's DRM'd. So we're preventing that content visually leaving the environment. So, you know, again, depending on the workload, there's different behaviors there, but DLP is something that you have to take part of. You mark your content a certain way, and we'll respect it on the sharing and collaboration side, right? Talk about the 900 controls. Our 900 controls grew out of what we call the FedRAMP or the NIST environment. It's the most stringent one that we have. But we have ISO, we have EU model clauses. And what we do is we try to look for commonality in these controls. And if we can find one that matches, we reuse the control. If a control doesn't exist, it's brand new, we add it to our list. So when we look at our list, our compliance obligation day to day, I'm not really thinking about FISMA. I'm not thinking about EU model clauses. I look at this list of 900. And if I can meet that list of 900, all of my obligations are guaranteed to be met, right? I don't focus on any one of them. I focus on them all by abstracting them into our control framework. And I meet those, we're good to go. These are the ones that we get over here. HIPAA, FedRAMP, FISMA, ISO. But new certs are coming all the time. So if you look at sort of how we do our compliance framework, somebody says, you know, in order to get into the China market or to get into the India market or just somewhere that we're not in today, we do a regulatory impact analysis. What will it take to get into that environment? Are they going to hold us to certain bars and requirements to get into it? So we do a complete analysis of should we be there? What are the obligations we have if we decide to go there? The last thing you want to do is open up shop and then realize that you can't meet those obligations and then bad things begin to happen, right? We look through all the controls. We understand what we can and can't do. We document. Once we're doing the activities, we go through what's called continuous monitoring. So again, not flexing that muscle over and over again. Once we have these controls up and running, we report monthly on these numbers. It's all automated. What's your patching looking like? What's your vulns look like? What's your time to recovery look like? You report out all of this into what's called a continuous monitoring program, and we're evaluated. Are we flexing the muscles on a regular basis, and how are we actually doing to our obligations? We go through audits, and you know, audits are a art. They're not a science. You would think that you go through one audit. I can do a ISO audit one month with one auditor. The next month, another ISO auditor can come in. He or she will interpret the rules slightly different, the controls slightly different, and hold me accountable to something different, right? So we're ever evolving. We're ever taking that high watermark, because if this auditor reads it that way, the next one could read it that way too. So we're ever saying, okay, well, last week it meant this, this month it means that. If we don't meet that bar, we begin to remediate. You know, we can't be held accountable for a changing definition, but we are held accountable for remediating to that new definition. So once we get our audit back, we have a period to remediate. We back up level everybody to the new bar, and we just cycle that thing over and over and over again. These are sort of more the technical boundaries. The way you think about Microsoft is we are the custodian, or in legal terms, we're the data processor in these environments, and the customer is the data controller, which really means it's your data, you control it. If you want to give it away, it's yours to give away. It's yours to breach whatever rules and security you have on that data, not Microsoft's. So you're the controller, we're the data processor. We contribute to that clearly. We don't give your data away, but ultimately it's your data, you own it. You want to take it out of the service, that's fine. If you put it into the service, that's fine, but you are the controller of that relationship. Talked about this one already, what you guys have to do to comply with your own regulations. All right. Now let's talk about the elephant in the room. So this is the NSA, the PRISM, the privacy discussion. Right? We're not going to go into a whole lot of detail here. right? But I'm going to give you our perspective on what's going on here. And everything I'm going to share with you here is public. Our general counsel has made these statements. And so there's, you know, I am not going to be apologetic for what governments may or may not be doing. I'm not going to, we're just going to have a simple conversation of what we're saying about this topic. Right? At the end of the day, we take your privacy seriously. Right? We build trust in our customers and in our tenants by living up to those commitments. Right? So, in the short end of it is, we only provide data in response to legal, targeted, lawful demands. Which means that whatever country you're in, there are laws that allow that government to make legal, lawful requests for a number of reasons. And this is what we are obligated by law to participate in. And this is the whole, unfortunately, what's happened recently is our ability to disclose how many and try to categorize them to paint a picture, at least a broad abstract picture of how big this is and what was actually done has been limited by law. That's slowly beginning to loosen up again. But essentially, you know, by default, no one has access to customer data, right, until we authorize it. We're obligated to comply with all the government laws. We respond to legal demands. We only pull and provide specific data mandated. We don't say, well, here's everything they did. If the lawful request is for this piece of data, that is the minimal piece of data that they will be given, right? Everything is requested and reviewed by counsel, both at the Microsoft level and at the country level, and that we do our utmost best to do all of this. Now, here's kind of what it does mean. You're thinking, okay, well, that's part of what's being said. What's really not being said, right? Here's what we do and what we don't do, right? We do not provide any government access without direct lawful request to your data. We're not complicit in, here's a network tap, go listen all you want, right? There are things that we are not complicit in providing these people, right? How they gain this access, I can neither confirm nor deny. I have no part of it, right? But it's not something that Microsoft is doing today to provide compliance to their activities, right? We don't assist in any efforts to break encryption or provide the government with any first 1,000 bits of our encryption keys, right? We're not giving them a leg up by giving them data to help them, right? We don't engineer backdoors into the environment, right? We're not involved in any surveillance programs, right? So you look at all of this, and this states out clearly what we do and what we do and why we do it, right? And there is lots to be said, and I can't go into details about what Snowden says. It's not saying what the documents read. This is our public statement about what Microsoft is doing in this space and not doing. And so it may not be satisfying. You may not get all the answers that you want out of it, but this is a clear, at least, statement, as clear as we can do to at least position our participation. I thought I had one more slide. Nope. They must have cut it out. I did have a slide in there that actually, I'll make sure it's in the copy of the notes you get, is there are some public links to what our general counsel, Brad Smith, has published, the blogs and all the stuff where we've made this statement and case out. I'm going to make sure that's in the deck. I'm not sure where that slide might have gotten hidden or something, but I'm going to put that in there. I'm finished. I'll take your question right at the end. We're finished. Here's the schedule. There's an Ask the Expert session tonight in the pavilion downstairs. So if you have time to do that tonight, highly recommend it. All the Microsoft folks and our partners will be around the tables, and all questions are eagerly anticipated. I believe it's table based. I think there's birds of a feather. I think if here's an IM chat table, here's a conferencing table type thing. Here's some ways to give feedback. Birds of a feather, that's on Wednesday. if you're tweeting, if you're hashtagging, these are the blessed ones. Tag away. We've seen that slide out in the lunch hall. I think the last one is out in your evaluations. I hope you found it interesting. This topic is too deep to spend. We could spend a day on every one of these topics. It's meant to be a broad, I'll go back to that, broad smattering of information. If you enjoyed the session, please fill out your evaluations. If you didn't, bring them up. I'll fill them out for you. And you can win some prizes if you hand those in. All right, so I got some time for questions. They've asked me to get you up to the mic to ask your questions because they go onto the recording. So I can either repeat them or you can stand up at the microphone. Are we transferring data between data centers? Looking at? So the answer is yes, but you need to double click into that, right? So data is legitimately traversing between data centers at the application layer, meaning if you instant message me from Europe and I'm in the US, your data will transfer. What you're really asking about is data sovereignty, is where is it stored and maintained. So EU model clauses, and there are a bunch of data sovereignty rules that we have, and it's not black and white. It doesn't actually say, and if you look at the EU model clauses, it doesn't say you can only store European data in Europe. If you read them, and they're public, there are provisions to store some of that data in the US. You have to set things up in advance legally, but there are provisions to store some of that data in the US. Typically, EU model clauses says we will not store any of your Europe data in China, in Asia. So those provisions are more or less geared to don't do this, and if you have to do this, come talk to us. So it's not black and white. You can't just say Europe's in Europe, North America's in North America, but it's a tenet that we try to strive for. So when I do my compliance reviews with the component teams, and they say, well, we have all this data, I'm saying, okay, where are you storing it? Well, we're going to put it all in North America. Why are you putting it all in North America? Well, it's easy. Doesn't make it right. You need to have a European repository for this data. You need to have an APAC repository. Oh, but it's this type of data, and it all has to be held together. Okay, now let's go through the exception clause. Here's why it all has to be held together, and it'll be a copy in Europe and USA. And so we go through this process by which it's not just a given, you can put the data wherever you want. It's under business rules and business reasoning. So not a black and white answer, but it's not, we're not free to do whatever we want. Answer your question? Okay. Any other questions? All right. Well, I appreciate your guys' time and enjoy the rest of the conference.